versus Commonwealth, Mr. Hutchison and Mr. Uberman. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Mr. Hutchison, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. May it please the court, my name is Carlos Hutchison and I represent the appellant Cynthia Latrice Porter in this matter. The appellant respectfully requests that the court remand this case for a new sentencing hearing based on trial court error and denying the accommodation instruction in this case. In this case, the court denied the instruction prior to the finding of guilt, which was procedurally not the proper time. To make a finding there,
Do you agree that the evidence presented at the guilt trial would not support an accommodation instruction if that's all there were? The officer's testimony and the ultimate purchaser's testimony.
We do not, Your Honor. The case law says if there's a scintilla of evidence and the denial of an instruction, the standard is it's reviewed in the light most favorable to the proponent. Based on that standard, it's our position that there was sufficient evidence at the guilt stage. Or even more importantly, if the defendant has a burden during the guilt stage, the defendant has no burden. The way the statute is written.
But if the defendant had not testified at sentencing, so all we had was the evidence presented at the guilt phase, I'm trying to understand how that would support an accommodation instruction, because the testimony seems to indicate that A, it was a commercial transaction, and B, there was some profit accruing to the defendant.
Your Honor, we pointed out a number of facts in our brief. One, the parties knew each other, it used drugs together over an extended amount of years. One of the witnesses, Cruz, testified he would go pick up the appellant and they would go somewhere else, purchase drugs, go back and use the drugs. So they were co-users of drugs. It wasn't a seller-buyer relationship.
Well,
go ahead. The for an accommodation to apply, there has to be no intent to profit. Would you agree with me on that?
Yes.
Okay. She bought. The testimony was that she bought the marijuana for $17.50 a bag and sold it at $30 a bag. Isn't there a profit in that?
Your Honor, and technically there is. The problem in this case is, and the appellant testified during sentencing, but Cruz gave her $30 to go in with her. They went in together. He said, we threw in together to go get it. She didn't know how much they were going to be charged for it, is what she testified to. So then they purchased it, got back in the car. Before they got to their destination, they were stopped. So if there was any redistribution of change or a breakdown, they never had the opportunity
to occur. Mr. My problem with that argument is that when the trial court made its ruling, the trial court had not heard that testimony. And after the trial court heard that testimony, there was no request for an accommodation instruction. So I have a hard time trying to figure out how we could say the trial court made an error.
And Judge, counsel was put in a difficult position. The trial court stated that we talked about accommodation prior to the guilt finding. The court denied it, said no accommodation instruction. Counsel said, respectfully, once we come to sentencing stage, that's when we'll put forth evidence on accommodation. Trial court said, no. You won't put forth evidence if I don't give the instruction, and I've ruled there's not sufficient evidence for the instruction.
I read that the trial court said you're not going to get the instruction unless there's evidence to support it.
And I believe the quote in the transcript.
Or you're not going to argue it unless there's an instruction.
When we argue accommodation, I'd imagine that's the proper time. We don't argue sentencing unless the court gives the instruction regarding accommodation. And I've ruled there's not sufficient evidence before the tribunal to give the accommodation instruction.
At that time?
At that time.
Which is probably correct, given King versus Commonwealth, Hudspeth versus Commonwealth, all of the cases that say that any a commercial transaction constitutes profit.
We agree, Your Honor. But that statement from the court was in response to counsel's statement that, okay, well, we'll present that at sentencing. Counsel's statement immediately prior to that. And at sentencing, when we argue accommodation, I would imagine that's the proper time to put forth that there is evidence that there, you know, it was an accommodation, and the court said, no, you don't argue accommodation.
But why didn't you give the court an opportunity and request it to reconsider its decision based on the new testimony from the defendant? Judge, we have now presented evidence to support this instruction, and we think such an instruction is proper. Wouldn't that have been the way to preserve the issue for appeal?
And counsel had to make a decision whether we go against the court's ruling. The court said, you don't argue it, when the court still had to rule on my client's sentencing. We did, nonetheless, file a motion to reconsider prior to the sentencing, asking the court, raising the issue and asking the court to consider the error in not giving the accommodation instruction. But counsel would, what do you do when the court says you don't argue that? Do you argue it anyway?
You didn't have to argue it. You simply had to renew your request for an instruction, because the instruction was not given until after the instructions were considered. I mean, I understand the instructions were considered while the jury was out deliberating guilt or innocence. And I agree with your argument that technically it probably should have been done after the evidence was presented at sentencing. Mm-hmm. And the trial courts sometimes get in a hurry in these kinds of cases. But I don't understand why you could not have asked the court, after the defendant testified, to reconsider its decision regarding the accommodation instruction.
And I believe we could have. The court said our objection was noted. We noted our objection. We felt like we made a record. We did ask our client questions at sentencing to make a record to put forth evidence on accommodation. And we figured we'd have to address these issues on appeal. But we didn't want to, while the defendant, my client, was still in the grasp of the court, we didn't want to offend the court by going directly against an order of the court that you don't do something.
Well, and I understand you don't argue it until I give the instruction. The court didn't say, under no circumstances will I even consider giving that instruction.
Right. The court said, you don't argue it, and he noted our objection for the record. And so the objection is noted. We didn't feel that
at that time. Was there any proffer made when the sentencing instructions were being considered as to what the defendant would testify that would then make the instruction proper?
Judge, I believe I was about to make a proffer. I imagine it's a proper time to put forth that there's evidence that the price varies and it's a reasonable inference, and I was cut off by the court with the court saying, we don't argue sentencing unless I give the instruction. And in the heat of the battle, Your Honor, you have to make a decision. Do you upset the court against your client, or do you note your objection and keep going forward? And that's what counsel did.
I understand your dilemma. I've been there, and I have the scars remaining to prove it. But I don't understand how we can tell the trial judge, you erred because you didn't give an instruction that you weren't requested at the appropriate time to give.
I understand, Your Honor. It was denied prior to the proper time. And it's in the light most favorable to the proponent of the instruction. We submit respectfully that there was sufficient evidence of accommodation, that the court remand for a new hearing on sentencing, and that that the objection was timely noted, And I understand the courts, why didn't we re-raise our objection for the record, but it was noted for the record. But I absolutely understand. And we raised it. That's the one thing. We filed a motion to reconsider. So we raised it after the sentencing stage. So when the court had a sentencing hearing, they had before it our renewed objection that we didn't get the accommodation instruction. At that point, the court would either have to call a new jury or the same jury for a sentencing hearing, or if that jury had expanded, have another sentencing hearing, or have grant a new trial. I don't know. But we did raise the issue before the court finished the case.
All right. You're into your rebuttal. You may continue or reserve.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Huberman?
May it please the court, David Huberman on behalf of the Commonwealth. It's the Commonwealth's position that Rule 5A.18 precludes the court's consideration of Porter's assignment of error because she failed to renew her request for that accommodation instruction after the penalty phase. The trial court appropriately concluded when argument was presented to it that no evidence supported the submission of an accommodation instruction, and it also noted Porter's exception, as Mr. Hutchinson just noted. But it was incumbent upon Ms. Porter to renew her request for that instruction at the conclusion of the penalty phase, presumably based upon some evidentiary basis in her testimony that was not previously before the court. Porter erroneously contends here that it was the trial court's error during, quote, the guilt phase of the trial. This contention, however, absolves her of all responsibility and neglects the fact that the parties voluntarily engaged in a discussion and argument at the sentencing instructions while the jury was deliberating Porter's guilt. So what the trial court did was rule on the sentencing instruction when it was asked to do so. So Porter's reliance in this court and Foster for the proposition that whether the defendant acted only to accommodate a friend is a determination that should be made after the guilt phase is inapplicable because, again, the parties voluntarily engaged in that discussion while the jury was deliberating guilt.
Did the defendant's testimony require the giving of an accommodation instruction?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that it did. And to answer that question, I'll jump to the merits. And the reason why I don't think it did, and I agree with Mr. Hutchinson, you know, the standard is in the light most favorable to the proponent of that instruction. But trial courts have discretion in determining which assignment or which instructions to grant, and the defendant has the burden to establish an accommodation defense. But the standard, the light most favorable to the proponent, does not mean that the trial court should disregard competent evidence to the contrary. And in this case, there's evidence, as the court recited, that Ms. Porter sold the heroin, in this case, two bags of heroin, for a net profit of $25. And there was no evidence whatsoever that Ms. Porter was friends with Mr. Cruz, the purchaser of the drugs. There was simply evidence that the two had known each other for 1 or 2 years. And as the trial court, I think, aptly noted, drug dealers know their buyers for a period of time. Just the duration of their transactions has nothing to do with whether they were friends or not. And I think it's relevant that Ms. Porter, on appeal, relies not solely, but large in part, in an unpublished decision of this court in Mondito versus Commonwealth. Not only that, but actually the dissent of that opinion, the majority in Mondito actually affirmed Mondito's conviction for distribution of cocaine and, in fact, rejected her accommodation instruction. And in doing so, the court said that accepting Mondito's argument, even if the fact finder chose to disregard the most incriminating aspects of an undercover police officer's purchaser's testimony, that the evidence proved that she did not solely intend to accommodate the undercover officer purchaser. And in this case, it's clear that Ms. Porter was not intending solely to accommodate Mr. Cruz. Now, Mr. Cruz testified during the guilt phase that he was going through heroin withdrawal and that he went to Ms. Porter and that together the two of them drove to a Hardee's restaurant where they met another individual, Ms. Wright, and that's from whom Ms. Porter purchased the drugs, who she in turn sold at a profit of $25 to Mr. Cruz. That in and of itself, I think, is a sufficient basis to negate any accommodation sentencing, even in light of Ms. Porter's testimony at sentencing that, again, it's self-serving. If the court were to offer an accommodation sentence or an accommodation instruction in this case, it would do so in every case where a defendant simply testifies at sentencing that I only sold the drugs to this person because he or she was my friend. It completely ignores the, I think, overwhelming evidence that was set forth in the guilt phase that she did this for profit.
But that's not the test for an instruction. The test for giving an instruction is there a scintilla of evidence to support it? And that often can be just the defendant saying, I did it for a friend.
Yes, and Your Honor, I have two responses to that. The first is that within the confines of this case, it's waived because Ms. Porter did not raise that issue at the conclusion of sentencing. But to substantively respond to the court's question for the sake of argument, I agree that certainly is the standard. But again, the additional evidence in this case detracts from that scintilla of if Ms. Porter's testimony that, hey, I only sold these drugs to this person because he's my friend, supported that scintilla level standard, the additional evidence that came out at trial that she had sold this, you know, on numerous occasions. In fact, Andrews, who was Cruz's girlfriend and was present at the time of the transaction, testified at sentencing that on approximately, she answered numerous times, but once she said 20 to 30 occasions, another time she said 20, another time she said more to 10, but on each of those occasions, she purchased heroin from Ms. Porter at a price of $30 per bag. So the Commonwealth's response would be twofold, Your Honor. First, that it's waived, and second, that the additional evidence in the record detracts from Ms. Porter's argument. And in light of that evidence, it simply wouldn't accommodate jury instruction.
Well, I guess the question is where the evidence establishes that it was a commercial transaction, and there is also evidence that it was done as a favor. Is the instruction appropriate?
And I think, Your Honor, it's not. And that's consistent with this court's prior holdings. It's consistent with Mondito, which is unpublished, but it's also consistent with Hudspeth, which the Commonwealth cited in its brief, which is a published decision, I believe, from 98. And there the court held that the evidence was insufficient to support the defendant's request for the instruction when she sold marijuana for the same price at which she purchased it. And the court noted that the fact that Hudspeth did not sell the drugs for more than she paid for them is of no consequence. And with respect to the court's question in terms of the relationship between the parties, Foster, I believe, would be the case most on point. And there, with the court's indulgence, court noted that section 248.18.2, 248D provides for mitigation of punishment for a defendant convicted of distribution who is found not to be a drug dealer, but to be simply an individual citizen who's acting to accommodate a friend, but then doing so without the intent to profit and without the intent to further drug use. And in this case, again, certainly there was evidence of intent to profit and there was evidence of furthering drug use because both Cruz and his girlfriend testified that they had purchased drugs with Porter or from Porter on numerous occasions.
Did the defendant deny that there was money exchange of money when she purchased the drugs when she testified, or did she deny that she had had gotten a discount from what she was charging the person she was buying for?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, she confessed to the arresting officer, Detective Hinckley, that, you know, she purchased the bags, as the court already noted, at $17.50 per bag, sold two of them to Mr. Cruz for $60, so netted $25. That was a statement she made to the police.
But what about her testimony at sentencing? Did that contradict any of the other evidence regarding the amount she charged Wright and the amount she sold the drugs for?
I don't believe that it did, Your Honor. Her testimony at sentencing was extremely
Cruz,
brief.
I'm sorry.
And yeah, certainly. It consisted of about a page and a half of the actual appendix, and she explained what she attempted to say was that it was more of a quid pro quo. Well, that we went together because he needed drugs and I needed a car ride, presumably to buy more heroin. When she was arrested, two bags of heroin were found in her pocket. Another six bags were found in a pack of cigarettes. So I don't believe that she testified with respect to the profit or the payment issue. She simply tried to, again, offer that it was a quid pro quo, and which would be consistent with her theory that, you know, she was trying to accommodate Mr. Cruz. But again, to answer the court's question, I simply don't believe that qualifies for an accommodation instruction, and that's consistent with this court's decisions in Hudspeth and Foster and the unpublished decision of Mondito cited by the appellant. Unless there are any additional questions by the court, I'll simply ask that the court affirm the circuit court.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hutchison, do you agree that there was no evidence presented that this was not a drug purchase for consideration, a commercial transaction?
No, Your Honor. I believe when the appellant was speaking with Detective Hinckley, Detective Hinckley testified that she kept saying she's not a drug dealer, she's not a... and he explained to her, well technically, you did make some profit. And she said, well, she didn't know. Marcy gave her a discount. She just gave her the money. She explained.
But there's absolutely no evidence in this case that this purchase was not made for consideration.
That she actually made... No, there is no evidence that she did not...
So did he
pay more for?
If there is evidence that there was consideration received or expected, which is what Heacock says profit means, then even after her testimony, why would she be entitled to an instruction?
Your Honor, I believe the important part of that statute is expected or intended. Was it her intent to profit, or did she expect to profit? She testified that she did not. Even her statement to the officer indicated that she did not intend to profit, but technically she may have.
But it's not. In King, profit means a commercial transaction in which there is a consideration involved. It does not necessarily mean that the seller has to sell his drugs to a buyer at a price in excess of the amount the seller paid for the drugs. It doesn't have to be a profit. There simply has to be consideration, a commercial transaction. And there is absolutely no evidence in this case, even after she testified, that this was anything but a commercial transaction for consideration.
And Your Honor, I believe one of those cases the court found that although there wasn't a financial profit, that the mother benefited from having the son, helping the son distribute drugs, and therefore that was some consideration. In this case, there was no intent by Ms. Porter to profit. Mathematically, as the detective explained to her, if she didn't give Cruz any money back, she would have profited some, but she indicated she had no intention to profit, and that's technically what the accommodation instruction, according to the General Assembly, what the accommodation applies.
I mean, I read the cases concerning accommodation to mean that the accommodation provision applies if you're sharing drugs. If somebody, you know, passes the joint around, I mean, technically that's a distribution, but you're not. There's no money changing hands. There's no consideration, so therefore it's an accommodation. But I don't know of any case that says if it's a financial deal, if there's money passing hands, that it is in any way accommodation.
And, Your Honor, we point to Cruz's testimony that he called Ms. Porter, said, I'm feeling sick. I have to go to work tomorrow. Can you help me out? That was he was asking her to accommodate me. Help me out, please. He testified to that. That's his sworn testimony. She testified, he came, picked her up. She needed to get something also. He provided the ride. They threw in together, so she had the money prior to meeting the seller, and she didn't know what the ultimate price would be. But it was absolutely, and I understand the court, but it's absolutely accommodation when Cruz is saying, I called her because I'm feeling sick and asked her, can she help me out? It's our position that that is what an accommodation is, to accommodate someone. And Mr. Cruz said that was it, and Ms. Porter also testified that that was her intention, to help him out. Judge, we'd also like to point out, counsel noted Mondino that it was a dissenting opinion, and as we noted in our reply brief, that the court in Mondino, the dissent cited Brown and for the proposition that when the evidence is subject to multiple interpretations, it's within the province of the jury to determine whether the distribution was made for a profit or accommodation. And that's why we wanted it to go to the jury. It's our position it was a jury question, and that the jury should have been permitted the opportunity to assess the evidence on that question as it related to accommodation.
Thank you very much for your argument. We